Coming up in this podcast, Perth's luxury suburbs, crayfishing drama, tourism downturn, bumper grain harvest, Mindaroo's new CEO, and our special report on the increasingly important and newsworthy aged care sector.
Welcome to Mark My Words, the weekly podcast from Business News, with Mark Pownall and Mark Beyer discussing the important business news and data stories from Western Australia.
Welcome to our first podcast of 2019, and welcome back, Mark Beyer. Mark, first up, property remains a popular subject for our audience, and none more so than the luxury burbs. What is the news in the new year?
Thanks, Mark. Well, look, as our listeners would be aware, the residential property market in Perth has been pretty flat for several years, but the latest data shows that there have been pockets of quite substantial growth. We had some interesting stats out from the Real Estate Institute of WA. They listed the top 10 suburbs in Perth. Generally, your sort of upper end markets close to the water.
Right.
So Mount Pleasant, growth of 25% last year, according to REWA data. Claremont, 23%. Other ones that did well, West Leederville, Kensington, South Perth. Now, a qualifier here, these numbers can get distorted by the pattern of transactions within those suburbs.
Yep.
So we're not suggesting everything in those suburbs has gone up by that much. But it does show you that within an overall soft market, there's still some good gains being made. I mean, look, overall though, the median house price in Perth fell by 1.9% last year to $505,000.
Mm-hmm.
So overall, and of course this comes in a market where Sydney, Melbourne, and pretty much every other state has seen a weakening in their residential property markets as well. The banks are being scaling back their lending. So, you know, a lot of concern nationally about where things are headed.
So I got some questions without notice. What do we recall the median house price got to? Was it close to 600?
It was close to 600 at one stage, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So I can't remember if it went over or not. I should have that number etched in my memory, but I don't.
And it's been about 6 or 7 years where it's basically been flat.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's gone backwards.
Flat to down.
And it's gone backwards. I mean, we're sort of talking, generally speaking, 2007 prices, aren't we? And that's what we've been sort of saying. It's actually gone in reverse for 10 years. And also, just a couple of queries about the, you know, just Mount Pleasant and Claremont. Interesting, there at the top. A lot of apartment development in both those suburbs. I wonder if that's influential in that at all.
Look, I would have thought that would actually tend to bring down
the
median if those figures get fed into this database.
Hmm.
I mean, there are some quality apartment developments in both those suburbs, but I would have thought they would tend to be below, you know, the median for Mount Pleasant. Is 1.2 million.
Yeah, okay.
For Claremont, it's 1.5 million.
Okay.
Now, I would have thought apartments generally are going to be below that level.
Maybe not. Maybe the ones that have sold might be, you know, the ones that the first ones in some of those developments might be the higher end ones. Interesting. Well, you know, we can ask Dan Wilkie, property writer, to dig a bit deeper, perhaps.
Yep. And look, in that regard, we also had some information out about the outlook. Mm-hmm. For residential property values. Now, as we've seen for a while now, there's conflicting opinions in the marketplace about where things are headed. Now, CoreLogic and Moody's, who do a lot of work analysing the market, they're a bit negative. They're tipping a 2.8% fall in 2019 in the median house price, followed by a rebound in 2020. When they're seeing a growth in population come through, once again, off the back of mining investment and projects and so on. And yet Domain, the property website, they're more positive. They're talking about 5% growth this year. So that's surprisingly bullish. And also the Urban Development Institute of Australia, they've done some analysis looking at the linkage between mineral investment and housing prices. And they see a lag of a couple of years. So presumably on the basis that after the exploration drilling, that's followed by project investment. Yeah, you know, I think that's a interesting hypothesis. But they're talking about growth over the next 12 to 18 months.
Okay.
But nobody's talking about big changes
in
residential property values.
Although 5% in a year is, you know, not insignificant under the circumstances.
And certainly more than we've seen for a long while.
Well, look, it's interesting, and you know, I've been talking about that sort of internally as well. Does the downturn in the East Coast now drive investment into WA? Just because, you know, money's got to find a place, and could, you know, WA's kind of reached a bottom, we all keep thinking, although, you know, last year, as you point out, we lost ground. Secondly, are we going to see people coming into the state and take that opportunity? It's now affordable to come and move here and live here, and now there's some job opportunities coming. So it'd be nice if there's a bit of a revival on that front, but, you know, anecdotally, we're not seeing a lot of that yet, so maybe it is the 2020 revival is more accurate. I guess we'll just have to wait and see. Now, Mark, crayfishing, as it used to be called, or the rock lobster industry, as it's more recently dubbed itself, they've launched a big fight back against the state government proposal to increase the catch, but require the new quota to be sold in WA. So what are the key issues here?
Yeah, look, this is one of those classic sleeper issues. This was stems from some announcements made by the Minister, Dave Kelly, back on the 8th of December. He talked about major changes to the Western rock lobster industry. Now, that's an industry that's had quite an ups and downs over the years. Mm-hmm. There was a stage where there was sort of concern about overfishing and the sustainability of that fishery. They had a change in the way they manage it. They went from pots to quota system, and generally acknowledge that it's now very well run in a very sustainable manner. Mm. The minister's come out and said, look, we're going to increase the overall quota, the overall catch, from 6,300 tonnes to 8,000 tonnes. This will be done gradually over several years. But perhaps even more interesting, he's saying that extra catch will primarily, if not exclusively, be reserved for the domestic market.
Yep.
Now, he certainly upset a lot of people in the industry, and there's been some quite alarming predictions made that it's going to slash the value of quotas, that prices will fall. Now, I struggle to see, to substantiate some of those more alarmist suggestions. Also been suggestions that the government is nationalising part of the industry. Now, once again, that seems a very long bow to draw when, you know, like most natural resources, they're sort of governed, or government has a role in managing them, and selling quota for this industry is a well-established practice.
Yeah.
I think where the government's been struggling is to substantiate some of their predictions. So the minister came out and said there was potential to create 500 jobs and double the value of the industry. Yeah, that's drawing a very long bow as well. Mm. The gist of
it is...
Is
that the suggestion that by doubling the value of the industry means there's going to be more people employed locally, so therefore more money stays in the state? Is that because you can't double the value of an industry by increasing catch by 17%, can you?
Well, that's right. And in fact, looking at the information the government's released, I'm struggling to find anything to substantiate what he's got there. But yes, I think it is on that basis that there would be more an increased supply for the domestic market, because basically all the rock lobster gets exported to international markets at the moment. Mm. He's saying, let's keep a bunch of it here in Western Australia for international visitors to WA and for local customers.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a logic for that, but it needs to be done in a way that is sustainable, and you've got to bring the industry with you. And so far, he's failed dismally in doing that.
Yeah, it's a pretty fascinating industry. I mean, I spent a lot of time in the 90s and the early 2000s covering and watching this industry quite closely. And it's changed so much, and some of the big players have disappeared completely, and it's really consolidated. And then there was a real crisis, can't remember, it was about 4, 5, 6 years ago, where they had a real problem. They did seem to have, the crayfish seemed to disappear to an effect. and they couldn't catch them. At that stage, they shifted to this quota system, which took the pressure off the industry or off off the fishery, because under a system where you bought a pot, that gave you the you were allowed to fish between a certain period of year. So the idea was that when prices were high, people would fish like crazy, and you know, kind of dampen the market. And when the craze were there, you just had to get them. Whereas now with a quota, it's smarter to get them when the prices are higher. Sorry, that's the shift. I guess with this move, the question you've got is there enough out there to catch? I presume the state government believes the science is behind it to say it is there.
I mean, there was a report that came out and said there was potential to increase the catch by about 5% a year.
Mm-hmm.
And broadly, that's what the government is doing.
Okay.
I mean, theirs amounts to, I think, a 27% increase over time.
Gotcha.
Some of the commentary that's come back from the industry is that, because they've had a 10-year plan for the industry, some of their concern is that the minister has latched on to parts of their 10-year plan, but seems to have a very aggressive agenda or timetable for achieving what they saw as long-term opportunities in the industry.
Yeah. And I guess if I was a fisherman, and, you know, I'm always cautious about, you know, I've acquired my right, and that did change from a pot to a quota. And that quota can be put up and down by the government, right? So there's X amount of license holders, and I presume they each get a bit of quota based on what the government says they can fish each year. So if I was a fisherman, maybe I'd say, well, why don't I just get an increased quota to catch with my license? And therefore, and perhaps the government could say, but you've got to sell that increase in WA. Maybe I'd be more open to that idea. But of course, the government wants to raise more money and presumably inject more competition into the sector. I don't know. It's a strange one. I'm not quite sure what the objective is. Obviously, the final outcome in all this was local people are whinging about crayfish prices in the shop and that they can't get any. Now, that's been a pretty big issue for about 25 years, so I'm not sure that the state government really needs to change that. But anyway, we'll see, huh? Now, Mark, there's been much talk about efforts to revive WA's tourism sector. It appears that current strategies are failing based on the numbers.
Yeah, look, we had some new figures out during the week. Nationally, there's effectively a boom going on in international tourism. Strong growth across the country as a whole, but not in WA. Number of international tourists coming to WA in the year to September rose by only 1%. Tasmania up 13%.
Yeah,
now, right. I in fact spent a week in Tasmania recently.
So you were part of that.
And the presence of international tourists there is very apparent.
Yeah.
And they're well set up to look after the international tourists. You jump on buses and ferries and so on, and the voiceover comes through in Chinese as well and other international languages. Lots of signage for the international tourists. So Tassie is doing very nicely at the moment.
Right.
You know, Queensland, New South Wales, other states have all seen strong growth in international tourists. But what's even more worrying for WA is that while there's been this 1%, a very minor uptick in number of international tourists, spending has in fact fallen by 7%. And this is a pattern that we've seen for quite some time. And this is an industry that the government has kept on talking about as part of diversifying the economy and getting jobs in other industries outside mining and so on.
And but I'm right in hearing that spending drop is also partly because hotel prices have come down so much due to both the market being damp and more competition in hotel availability.
Yes. In fact, the Minister, Paul Papalia, has raised that argument in defending these figures.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've not seen any sort of detailed analysis to underpin that, but, I mean, logic suggests that would be a contributor to that outcome.
But they're not going and spending the savings they made in hotel prices are not being spent in other places, obviously.
Evidently. And also the duration of the stay in WA by international tourists has been coming off as well.
It was lower, that's right. Okay.
Yeah. Yep. So clearly, relative to what's happening around the rest of the country, WA is underperforming.
We're missing out. It's our GST money being spent to promote other states at expense of our own opportunity. It's classic. It just keeps on going on. Do I need to say more?
There is a substantial allocation of money in the state budget for tourism promotion and marketing. But it's a bit like the discussions we've had around international education. Mm. Yeah, we're spending money in this field, but other states are spending a lot more and achieving a lot more return on their investment. Clearly, we need to do better.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, big problem. Now, Mark, farmers will be enjoying a remarkable coincidence of big yields and high prices. Unusual for those two things to coincide.
Look, the grain harvest in Western Australia this year is shaping up to be a record in value terms, and also a very good figure in volume terms. So the latest estimate is that the total grain harvest will be about 17.2 million tonnes. The largest ever was 2016, was about 18 million tonnes. Mm. So close to a record in volume terms. But also, we've had very buoyant markets for wheat and other grains. So the prices have come up. So total value estimated at about $6.5 billion.
Yeah, right.
So good times in the wheat belt and nice to see.
Yeah.
Particularly when, as we've been discussing, other industries are pretty soft at the moment. Compared to the East Coast, farmers there are doing it tough, drought conditions across big parts of the East Coast. And of course, that would be a factor in boosting those prices.
Yeah.
In fact, a substantial portion of WA wheat is going to the East Coast.
Yeah, unusually, right?
Yes. And internationally as well.
And the Aussie dollar's down, so, it all helps, doesn't it?
Mm. Yeah. So, good news for farmers.
Absolutely. Now, Mark, the Forrest family's charitable and private investment vehicle, Mindaroo, has appointed a new CEO. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, look, an interesting appointment, and also interesting to look at the latest numbers for Mindaroo. Now, Andrew Forrest announced during the week that they've recruited a guy named Andrew Hagger as the new chief executive. He recently left the National Australia Bank after coming under some very stinging criticism at the Banking Royal Commission in terms of the way in which he'd dealt with ASIC and the way in which he'd disclosed issues within National Australia Bank. Now, Andrew Forrest has acknowledged that, but it's certainly an interesting appointment to see someone who had copped so much criticism evidently landing on his feet and running what is now a very substantial organisation. Just last year, Andrew and Nicola Forrest put in just over $400 million into Mindaroo. Now, Mindaroo itself is an interesting entity. It's a mix of the philanthropic foundation, but it's also got lots of private investments in mining, agriculture, property and other areas. So it's a blending of the two in a way that's quite unusual.
Yeah.
But certainly at a philanthropic level, very active. They gave out donations and grants last year worth $56 million.
Mm. Yeah, right.
On our BNIQ database, we actually track all the major philanthropic foundations in Western Australia. So on that basis, it's overtaken the Telethon Trust as the most significant
prolific spender,
philanthropic trust in Western Australia.
Yeah.
Very large amounts of money involved there. Off the back of course, Andrew Forrest's one-third shareholding in Fortescue Metals Group.
Yeah.
He keeps on getting these big dividends year after year now.
Funny that.
Got to do something with the money.
Yeah, interesting.
Just one more interesting stat. Mindaroo now has 72 staff.
Is that right?
So a very substantial organisation.
Based at the old Sunset Hospital site there in Dalkeith.
That's right.
Yeah. Interesting, Mark. An interesting appointment. And I guess, first of all, Andrew Forrest has had his own tussles with ASIC over the years, so, maybe he sees that a bit differently. And secondly, I think, if you look through some of the appointments he's made over the years, I don't think it'd be outrageous to say that he's given some people a job when at a time maybe their job prospects looked a bit bleak because of something that had happened in their most recent, career. And, so he's kind of willing to back the person or whatever. And maybe he feels he gets a greater loyalty or he gets a discount. I don't know. You know, there's a whole bunch of reasons why, isn't there? But, interesting that he's willing to make such appointments. Now, Mark, our first special report of the year is on aged care. There's a lot of investment in infrastructure, but that is a sector that's facing some significant turbulence, like the banking sector.
We've got a Royal Commission coming up this year into the aged care sector, and it's causing quite a lot of consternation within the industry. People have looked at the Banking Royal Commission, and the revelations out of that were a shock to, I'd say, just about everybody. The extent to which there was poor practices in the banking industry. Now, the Aged Care Royal Commission was triggered by some shocking revelations about mistreatment of people living in aged care facilities. So it's going to be interesting to see just how much this Royal Commission discovers. Interesting, too, that it's a sector that's largely run by not-for-profit organisations and often to church-based organisations. So it's not like the big bad banks listed on the stock market.
No.
You know, these are meant to be the good guys who are caring and sharing.
But they've also been squeezed, haven't they, over the year. I mean, that's the claim, isn't it, that the government has slowly but surely reduced the amount over time that they are prepared to pay per person, per customer or client or patient or whatever you want to call it. And at the same time, regulation has increasingly ratcheted up, so it's more expensive to run. That would be, I imagine, one of the potentially root causes for some of the dramas that are there.
Yeah, no, fair enough. A fair comment. But it's also an interesting area because you've got a broad spectrum. You've got the a lot of people that are effectively independent living, still in their home, but now there's a greater focus on providing services so they can stay longer in their home.
Yep.
And, you know, some of the groups in WA like Silver Chain and Brightwater have made a big investment in meeting that market.
Yep.
There's also, aged care facilities where people can move into a unit but still live largely independently. Yep. But then right through to the other end of the spectrum when there's a more intensive level of care required.
Yep.
When people are more frail. And, of course, as our life expectancy increases, there are new kinds of health issues. So dementia is an increasing issue.
Yep.
As life expectancy increases. So lots of, it's a fascinating industry. It's a very large industry. Mm. As you touched on, there's a lot of investment in new facilities in Western Australia.
Yeah,
in our special report, we'll update on
growth
that.
Growth industry just due to the population rise in that area.
Yeah.
It's interesting, Mark, you talk about that too. You know, my understanding is what's happened there. Aged care, historically people went into aged care at a certain age and were in aged care at a reasonable level of health for a long time. Whereas now we're seeing people, like you say, they're staying at home for longer, entering aged care later and getting into that acute care stage much sooner. So there's high turnover. They're much more demanding on resources, and they don't. And having people in there for less time means, and I know this sounds a little clinical, but there's less value in the per person. You know, the value in having someone long term who doesn't need too much care. They've got a room, everything works, versus someone coming in, all that change over it. It's costly to do all that, and then the acute end is very expensive. So they've got a real problem there. I might add one other thing. One huge contrast to the banking sector. The banking sector is dominated by a big four nationally. And I reckon you look in our BNIQ search engine, look at that top group of aged care, none of them would be national players. They may have some national charitable link, but they're definitely a local thing. So this is a fragmented industry. I presume it's fragmented across the country in the same way. So very, very different than banking, which is, in the hands of four big players, and if you include super, five.
Mm. And look, as you say, for people that want to see who's who in the industry, we'll have an updated listing of aged care providers in WA. So, the big names, people like Aegis, Juniper, Regis, Bethany, Hall and Prior. So they're all ranked by number of beds and number of staff and so on.
Yep.
So that'll be published as part of the special report. also available on our website under the BNIQ tab, but also in our new book of lists.
Recently launched, Mark, yes. It's one of 43 lists in the book, and it looks spectacular, I might add. And online, more than 90 lists, 9,500 organisations and 35,000 executives. So fantastic. Obviously, the book is the cream of the crop of that. So you can check the book out for the top end, and then you can go online and get all the rest. And join the team from Business News and some industry leaders and entrepreneurs representing the best of West Australian business at a special luncheon next month to mark our 25th year. The event will be held on Thursday, 7th of February at the Hyatt. Tickets are available on our website or call our office and ask for the events team.
Thanks for listening to Mark My Words with Mark Pownall and Mark Beyer from Business News. For more information, please go to businessnews.com.au/podcasts. And to receive these regularly, search for Business News WA in iTunes or SoundCloud.